IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome once again to episode 84 of the Killing It,
Killing It Podcast.
I'm joined today, as always, by Dave and Ryan. And boy, our pre-show has now reached the point where we're actually doing a slide presentation.
and nobody in the world is surprised that it was me who popped out a PowerPoint slide, and it had many builds and animations on that PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, we're all warming up, and Ryan's like, I got to show you this slide. And then, of course, it has like five builds to it, too. So it's like he's dramatically building each portion of the slide.
I find even when I'm talking to friends and family about life things, that it's really much easier to make my point when I can point to my PowerPoint slide and say, just watch it build. It's going to all make sense.
I imagine that there's like a projector on your patio so that when people are at a barbecue, you can say, let me explain this to you.
Not only is there a projector that is in my house, but there is a portable projector that travels with me everywhere I go. It is literally one of the permanent things in my backpack, and it causes much interest among the TSA people. If and when I ever go through an airport, they have many questions about what is this little box. It's just a projector. Would you like me to show you a PowerPoint presentation? Right.
See, I can tell that I've now been like sort of podcasting and creating videos longer now, because I'm stopping to think of things in PowerPoint presentations, and now it's about videos. And like, I'm thinking about the like, oh, if I pull that one graphic, I could put it next to me. Like, that's now the way that I'm starting to think about these bits. It's like, yeah,
this is Darwin in a case study. Dave is adapting and evolving. Ryan is still being a dinosaur on PowerPoint.
Hey, you still get paid to travel and make presentations. So
that is totally true. I was very proud of myself too. In my latest video, I like threw up a graphic and then I like shifted my head next to it and stuff, like all with graphics. It was like to make space for this bigger graphic.
Because you can.
Because I can.
Exactly.
All right. I always used to say, you know, with PowerPoint especially, just because you have all of the fonts doesn't mean that you need to all of the fonts.
No, yeah. Comic Sans.
I had a guy one time was bragging about how he'd gone through this Microsoft training for making PowerPoints, and how, you know, they had spent all this money on him. And all I could think of is, if you learn to make Microsoft PowerPoints, dear God, that's the worst thing you could possibly do.
Yeah, never ever use 6-point type on a PowerPoint slide, damn it.
It's not Word.
All righty then, let's do a show.
Why not?
We have some interesting topics today, and of course, they're all related to future-looking technology, and I get to do the one on AI, artificial intelligence, and in particular, looking at using AI to correct problems with sex bias in drug safety trials. And this is, one of the reasons that I'm interested in this is that I know a little bit about statistics. I have a few college graduate level statistics classes under my belt. And it's always, always, always difficult to correct after you've collected the data, right? So if there's a bias in the data and you're trying to correct it afterwards, it's very difficult, right? And so artificial intelligence actually allows us to step up the game a bit with regard to that. And, you know, basically, create new samples and adjust the data in ways that we hadn't been able to do before. Obviously, part of this is leading to the discussion of, okay, well, maybe this just makes it obvious that if you see the same kind of bias again and again and again, we need to go back in the field and do the research right from the start, because we have to actually verify the AI models. But it certainly begins the discussion of redoing a lot of the data that we've collected, right? And of course, you know, the other side of the story is the concluding paragraph of every academic paper is more research is needed, which is to say, give me another grant.
Well, I mean, of course, but what I was, and you're exactly right, it creates that cycle. But what was interesting to me about this was we've talked about the problems of creating these models and based on giving them data that is, you know, that has all of these biases, and thus we have to factor that in as we think about it. It can create more. We've seen this in job resume AI and the way that that's kind of been done, that it actually, you know, creates and perpetuates the systematic bias. But for me, this was kind of very meta in that then I go up a level and go, well, if we become aware of the problems in the data, and then we use AI to fix the problems in the data, we can then create even better models going forward. And it's like this inception level of, right. of creations of data.
But it literally starts with being aware that you actually do have a problem.
Yes. Right?
Acknowledging like the data isn't the data. The data is... some data, but it's not the data.
See, the data is your point of view as the researcher and how you framed the question, right? The one of the most annoying cliches in business is, oh, you can use statistics to tell any story you want. No, you can't. You can design a survey vehicle to capture statistics that will tell any story that you want. But once the data, to Carl's point, once the data exists, the data has limitations, and you can only show what the data was designed to measure. I think in a world where more and more business leaders and decision makers of all stripes are saying, show me the data, has to be a data-driven decision, that's fantastic if the data is reliable. But if you are substituting your judgment and your experience and your gut feeling and replacing that with data, I mean, everybody in an MBA school would say, yes, yes, that's the very grown-up thing to do, unless the data is flawed. And I believe, we'll take this one step slightly more meta, I believe that there is not data that is not skewed right now because of who the people are designing the surveys. That's exactly why this kind of technology...
And, you know, it's interesting because... one of the things in the study of statistics that you always have to do is say, there are some certain tests to determine, is it this distribution, that distribution, where is the bias, how do we tease out the bias, and so forth. I'm actually going to email a friend of mine who teaches this stuff now to say, hey, are you using standardized, is there some standardized AI test that's being applied to data to see if we are finding a certain bias either in the collection of the data, the distribution of the data, right? The sampling system and so forth. Because AI may actually result in new tools for evaluating the integrity of the data itself that we hadn't had before.
Right. And a bunch of providers may be sitting here listening, going like, thinking that we're talking about like research and data sets and stuff and go, none of this is relevant. And I'm immediately going to go and point out and say, I continue to beat on this drum that anybody will listen, that there is massive opportunity right now for providers to help customers understand what data they have, how that data was collected, make sure that it's managed right, make sure that it is only what should be collected, what you intended to be collected, so you're not opening yourself up to risk to too much, but also in cataloging and preparing the data to do stuff with it. You can move into business analytics, you can move into business intelligence, you can start figuring out solutions that AI can apply to it. I still think that there's a massive bit of work to be done in just cataloging and organizing the data that's out there that is way more interesting to me than other kinds of services that we can go do.
Well, and there's a program a lot of people have access to and don't use called Microsoft Power BI, which is amazing. And once you begin to use it and realize there are certain ways that you can legitimately look at existing data and tease out relationships that you find there, and then, you know, begin to do. You always have to then go verify that you're finding what you thought you found. But Power BI can be used with client databases as well as public databases. So if a client has a lot of data that they might want to examine, you can learn how to do that. That's not a steep hill to climb.
No, and you're right. I think that this gets into exactly where the AI being designed to create more even-handed data sets. I think that that's a brilliant development in the industry. But what it does is supercharge the existing industry opportunity of reporting, analytics, modeling, predictive data, there is an unlimited amount of information. As a person who grew up inside the data, right? Like I've spent a lot of years selling database infrastructure and tools. There is more work than any of us have time for just in standardizing the data sets and making sure that the database fields all have the same number of characters. And there's a reason that DBAs they tend to be grumpy people, because data is not data unless it is fundamentally consistent. Standardization, normalization, aggregation, and then the analysis that comes from that. Everybody wants to say that right now, data is the new lifeblood of business. It is the asset that you have value as an organization. Your data is your IP. It is your commercializable asset. Yeah, unless the data is trash. And it is in almost all situations. And they customers, if they could do this for themselves, they would have. They need a professional to come in and begin with standardization and then start to draw analytics.
Ryan, we know we've run out of time because you have used your daily allocation of words that end in shun. Like, you have used them all. So, so time to move to the next topic.
Absolutely. It's always good when you can use big words in a coherent conversation, right? So our second topic that we want to move to is based on something that should be near and dear to the hearts of everybody listening. Ecosystems and communities that produce more than the sum of the parts, right? So the article that we're linking to is focused on the ability for us to generate new and more advanced offers, products, and services than any individual organization could produce on their own by getting big businesses, small businesses, customers, and consultants all together in a virtual think tank and challenging each other's ideas. The community aspect of this, like I said, solution providers are a community. You do the same things, you feel the same challenges, and you are much more effective when you can bounce your ideas off of other people. That's why we see in this industry a preponderance of, you know, peer groups and distribution communities and vendor communities. More than one person on this call operates a community, right? We live and breathe this stuff. What I find fascinating about this article is that it makes it much more tangible and tactical. Like, okay, if that is a better way to produce new offers, how do you actually make that happen? I'm fascinated because the two of you and doing what you do in this community approach, how can solution providers get involved in communities? How can they create their own and actually generate more interesting offers?
Well, you know what? I thought it was interesting to see big business, and small business getting together. And I wonder if there's this sense of incubators, right? Like, how do I get Daimler Chrysler to pay attention to what I'm doing, right? How do I get some of these really monster companies? I would love to see something like this come to a city near me, because I think it's a physical based thing, but I don't know that.
Some of it's digital. So my takeaway for this that I thought about a lot was, is obviously I've always said in my career that one of the things that I like about small businesses is small companies like doing business with small companies, mid-sized companies generally do business with mid-sized companies, large companies do generally business with large-sized companies. What's been interesting about the idea of ecosystems and community is it is a way of bringing together different size companies for collaboration. So you can be a large company, a Microsoft, a Google, a Zoom, a Salesforce, a company that creates a very large piece and build not just your platform, but an ecosystem around it that people can plug into, and thus you're creating value, but you're also creating value for them by what they build on top of it. And it creates the ability to connect different size customers in a collaborative way. That's really interesting to me that we've come to this. You know, Jay McBain is talking a lot these days about the move from channels to ecosystems. This was a way of thinking about ecosystem that bring those different size companies together that I had not quite said this way. And it made me realize as well, you know, maybe this is a way of breaking that down. And it lets small companies bring bigger leveraged backends to their own customers or even connect them to bigger customers.
Right. And the way this has actually happened traditionally has been through education. Right, that somewhere at some university they say, hey, let's get together and let's study either whatever space or flight or automobiles or something. And so, but those again tend to be very physical things, right? Like UC Davis, not very far from me, has for 30 years been studying different ways to power engines in ways other than burning gasoline, right? So right. Lots of car companies are putting in lots of money. Lots of small companies that you've never heard of are throwing in ideas, but it's around the university and again, around grants. I don't know why we had two topics in a row where that comes in, but
it's a theme.
But if you can take it online and say, all right, let's throw this up. You have to have the right big companies and you have to have some pretty energetic smaller companies that are willing to jump into that. But you know what? I'll bet you our audience has many, many clients who are those small companies who are doing things that they would love to engage with a Boeing or, you know, Aerojet or whoever.
And that's the thing, right? I can vouch from personal experience that some of the most tangible tactical things that I've ever learned in my career came from a community conversation. I had an idea. I put it into this conversation. Somebody with a completely different point of view, bigger company, smaller company, different role, said, Brian, that's dumb. You should do it this way. And I went, well, I literally never thought of it that way. And it completely opened up my mind. I find, because we work with a lot of very big companies and a lot of very small companies, vendor side, partner side, right? And one of the things we've always said is the value that we bring is that we speak native language on both sides of the aisle. I understand very large corporations and the dynamics and bureaucracies and how things get done. I also understand the entrepreneurial spirit of a very, very small company. And when you can speak native and translate to the other side, it's remarkable to me how many vendors are like, I've got this great new product. And we say, well, did you ever ask any solution providers if they thought it was a good idea? No, I never thought of doing that. We might want to facilitate some of those big little ecosystem conversations.
Well, you know, that whole like, maybe you should ask your customers and talk to your sometimes gets missed in all of this.
Well, but it also points out that, you know, sometimes companies try to do incubation in-house, right? And sometimes it works. I mean, you think about like Xerox Labs and so forth. But like I've worked with some really big, you know, they call themselves Fortune 10 companies, right? At one point I was working for two companies that both called themselves Fortune 10. It's like, you can't both be Fortune 10, but whatever. but they do stuff in-house. They take something in-house and say, here, go build a product. Here's $50 million. When you run out, if you don't have a product, you're done, right? And that's very, very different than going to a local company and saying, all right, so you know something about this product line. Help us figure out, is there a market? Is there a product? Is there a solution? What should we be doing so that we take advantage of the, you know, the next new thing that's coming down the road? Because there's a lot of very innovative companies that are out there doing manufacturing and other things. Again, they're probably the clients of some of the people who are listening to this podcast.
Well, so I think the piece to make this concrete is I would encourage people to take a look at this article, form some of your thinking about the way ecosystems are being done. And if you haven't dug into some of the discussions around ecosystems and what it means versus channels and stuff like that, you know, again, Jay McBain's got a bunch of material on this. I've spoken on this. There's a bunch of different materials that you should be looking at. I think this is a way of thinking that I would encourage everyone to take a look at.
And to put a real fine point on that, don't just go to communities that are made up of people who are all exactly like you. Like there's way too much peer-to-peer talking where we are all animals of exactly the same stripe and we all think exactly the same way about all of the issues. You know, a little diversity in that thinking process from different companies of different sizes might actually open your mind.
Well, so I'm going to take us into our last topic of the day, and I'm going to, this is a bit of an abrupt shift, so there's no good segue. I'm just going to go for it. So as we think about, you know, we have our last segment, which is often life after the pandemic. This one is a bit of life during the pandemic. And so the article I'm pointing at is entitled Why Contact Tracing Apps Haven't Lived Up to Expectations. For those that are not familiar with it, this is the idea of the doing contact tracing via electronic mechanism. Google and Apple came together and did some embedded into the operating systems methodologies way of doing that. And we just haven't seen quite the uptake that we would need. We were predicting anywhere between sort of 66%, 85% of potential app users would download it. And we're seeing it more turning out to be about 20%. Germany, it's about 21%. Italy, 14%. France, just 3%. Iceland and Singapore were the ones that got out the gate first. And they have the highest download rates, around 40%. So in broad terms, it's not nearly as successful as we'd really wanted it to be in terms of rollout. And the article points to lack of trust as being one of the key elements that are coming into it. So I'm coming to this group sort of saying, hey, I've been feel like I've been beating on another drum of the, you know, technology needs to look at why we're not trusted, particularly because in moments like this, when it's needed, we're having a trust problem. What's your guys' take on this lack of trust? Is the tech wrong, or is it really lack of trust? What's your thinking?
I have to question the lack of trust, because we trust a lot of stuff with a lot more information. And if you look at, during this time period, the growth of TikTok, for example, right?
Sure.
That's something where, I mean, it's actually in the news. Don't trust these guys. All your data goes off to China, you know, blah, blah, blah. And yet it's wildly popular. So if I've got the right enticement, the right payback, I will give up a little bit of my privacy in exchange for, you know, whatever, making the phone go ding, and get a little dopamine pump. But I don't know that there's enough of a tangible payback for me to say that I care about contact tracing.
Well,
we were talking before, I basically stay home during the COVID, right? So,
well, I mean, I'll go a step beyond that. The technology is perfectly fine to your question, Dave. It only works though if everybody is using it. It only actually achieves its intended purpose if it permeates a population, and then you can instantly in intricate ways track everyone, right? Like, that's the promise. And if only 20% of the people are using it, then it's fundamentally not capable, which is where people are not seeing, they don't see the payoff because they've not seen it fully functional yet. The bigger problem, and I will agree that it is a trusted issue. The examples in our industry that Carl was talking about, as well as others, we will give up our personal data in shockingly casual ways when that's not the explicit pitch. If you give me a farm game on my phone, I will let you have all of my personally identifiable information. If you let me make a 3-minute video and lip sync to a song, I will give you all of my personal data and let you take it to China. If you come straight out and ask me for my data, I would never give you my data. Yeah, you would. You absolutely are giving everybody all your data. I think that it's because the requests for data have been underhanded and masked, that when somebody comes out and says, I would like to have your location information, people think, oh no, I've heard all these stories that that's a bad thing. Well, only because they were sneaking, only because they were getting it not honestly in the past, that people don't trust a direct application. It's not the technology, it's not the data, it's the actors asking for the data. Like, if Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon come to you and say, I would like to follow every single
step. I do have to say, I don't think I've been asked for this. I don't remember seeing an ad to say, hey, it's in your best interest and in your city and your county and your state and the nation's best interest that you download this app I haven't seen anything where anybody has actually asked me at any level to download and install a contact tracing app. Other than this show, I don't know that I've heard anybody talk about it anywhere.
So, like, that's interesting.
PSAs?
So I'll say I have, right? So I live in Virginia. Virginia's Department of Health has run ads encouraging it. So I have actually seen it. I can say I can check that off. I'll kind of quip and go like, Carl, if I oversimplify your argument, you're essentially saying that if we put cat videos in the app, it is likely to get downloaded.
Well, that is true. But well, I have seen 1,000 ads for farm games in the last 8 months. I've not seen an ad saying, hey, you should download the contact tracing app. I haven't seen it from my healthcare provider or my state or my city. I'm like, where I live, it's not a thing.
So there's a couple of, this may be one of those classic situations where there's a couple of factors at play. I do believe there's a lack of trust going on here because people have heard so many scary stories. What's interesting is, of course, we don't have data on some of them. For example, Carl, I'll push back and go, well, TikTok sending data to China. Well, it's actually been investigated. We don't actually have proof of it. We have suspicion. Right. We have implication. We don't actually have proof, but it is certainly embedded itself.
Fear is in place.
Right. It's embedded itself in the public consciousness, partly because we have politicians that have been saying those kinds of things. We also have a lack of politicians encouraging, for example, the use of contact tracing apps. I've been talking about this and thinking about it in my head a lot recently, and I'm wondering if this comes down to a little bit of citizenship as a question. Like, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what our grandparents did in World War II, like the kinds of sacrifices that they made voluntarily. My favorite one recently that I've used a couple of times is talking about the idea of they actually started driving slower voluntarily because they learned that rubber was in a shortage, and so they could make their tires last longer by driving like 30 miles per hour as opposed to 50 miles per hour, because then you'll extend the life of your tires because of the rubber shortage. They weren't asked to do that even. They were voluntarily realizing that. And there was donation drives to gather up rubber. People bought war bonds. They invested time.
That gets to my point. If I were inundated or even saw one ad asking me to install the app, I probably would have. I would at this point have to go search for an app, contact tracing. I'm sure there would be lots of them, but...
Well, and Dave, I think to your original premise, right, is this a during the pandemic or a post-pandemic? Clearly, tactically, the execution is going to be post-pandemic because they've not done it well yet. But we now live in a post-World Series world. Go Dodgers. And anybody who saw anything coming out of that was, yay, baseball. What's that guy doing back on the field after a positive test? And now you can only begin to imagine the contact tracing complexity that will be required before any of those people can go back home again. Contact tracing will be a permanent part of our future. We have to get to the point where people think that's okay. And if you come out and ask people in today's cynical environment, will you allow all these corporations and government entities to know step by step where you go and when you go? Right now, the answer is hell no. We have to fix that. And I think you're probably onto something. Citizenship's probably the only way.
Well, it's interesting because I think then the concluding point to this has to be is like, look, technology doesn't solve problems on its own.
Right.
You have to invest in people, process, like the bits on top of it. And I think I'm going to wrap my thinking on this by saying the failure is that we created a technology that probably could help a lot, but we didn't do the work on top of it around people training, around education, around communication, the hard stuff, right? By the way, again, I'm going to always say this, the stuff a solution provider should be making money off of. Maybe not in this case, but that thematically is always where you should be looking because it's the heavy lifting, but it's where the actual payoff and success comes in.
Well, and it is an interesting reminder that, you know, this technology sounded cool at the beginning, but now that you think about it, Is contact tracing standardized enough that if we each three had three different apps, you could aggregate that data?
Well, so Carl, I will take a moment and educate you. The answer is yes, because across the smartphone platforms, they have standardized the exchange of information between them. These apps are built on top of the Google and Apple framework built into the operating system.
So any contact tracing app contributes to the whole.
To the whole, yes. And then the health departments simply set up their exchange of information. So for example, I have both the Virginia and the DC versions of that so that I'm in both regions. I'm logged in both regions on my phone because I have the option A to opt in and then B, which regions I am a part of. And those regions on the back end can also do exchanging in Europe.
And then does it just automatically track you where you wander about and...
What it does is it does exchange, it creates these hashes that understand which other devices, not based on location, but which other devices you have been in contact with. And thus the idea is if you then use the app and say, I have had a positive test, it notifies the other devices that you were in touch with that they have been exposed. That's the idea behind it. It's actually, if you want to dig into the technical pieces, it's a very well thought out privacy focused implementation because the data is somewhat is distributed and anonymized. So dig into that if you're interested on that. That is the basic premise behind the idea.
It's funny, and then we're almost essentially out of time, but to me, the most interesting piece is that at least where I live, I'm not getting any information on this. And you know, 8 months in where I don't know anything about this beyond what I've heard on this show.
Well, somebody needs to do the socialization of this.
And I'm not the most ignorant person you know.
No. and in a truly circular piece of logic, it only works because there is data standardization, aggregation, et cetera.
All right. Well, this was super much fun. Thank you once again for joining us. This has been episode 84 of the Killing It Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.